Bob.
Bob got all the gas he could use, but we never took the car out of Rockbridge County for 4 years. We never went anywhere by car, except once every 6 months, we would go to the Roanoke Hotel for dinner. And six people, we would go. And you'd think we were going to Europe. We would discuss what we were going to wear by the hour. And those champagne cocktails in that beautiful dining room at the Roanoke Hotel, it was the event that got us through for the next 6 months. Oh, we did go to New York once a year. We went on the train from Buena Vista sitting up all night, because if you did that, you only allowed 5 days in a hotel in New York. And so if you went one night on the train going and one night sitting up coming back, you could get one more day in there. And we wrote for theater tickets, and we went every single night, to say nothing of a couple of matinees, and roamed New York in a way that it just seems unbelievable that we could do this. There were special places. We always stayed at the same hotel, the Seymour Hotel, where the Saturday Review of Literature met every Monday luncheon for their editorial luncheon, and we'd look in and try to pick out which one was which. It was next door to the Algonquin, and so we would go in there and watch the Algonquin Round Table.
Oh, that must have been special.
It was kind of fun.
Now, you know, I picked up tidbits here and there, but I don't know. I haven't done enough research to really know. I've heard something about that there were some women who went through Washington and Lee during World War II.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
In fact, one of them's still here. Alta Fowler.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
They had summer school, and they took women during the summer school.
And were they on a degree program?
I think so. But after the first year, the Board of Trustees voted never to do that again. There were six. I wonder if Wade Wade is still alive. I don't know. Alta would know about him, because she's an alumnus before there were any women admitted. She would tell how many there were. There were only four or five. And there were certain courses. Somewhere along the line, the United States Army decided that they were not going to make the mistake which Britain had made in World War I by sending the cream of its youth to war. If you had, and, you know, in the Guns of August, the loss was, England, I don't think, has ever recovered completely from it. And so the very smart boys were sent to college instead, there were 900 of them, ASTP kids, and they came to Washington and Lee and took courses.
What did ASTP stand for, do you know?
Army Student something. I don't know. I don't think I ever heard.
Okay. So 900 of these people came to Washington and Lee at one time?
To go to college. They sent them to college instead of to war.
So along with the special services program, there was a regular college program going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't understand that.
Well, they were draftees. They weren't, they didn't apply to Washington and Lee. The Army sent them here.
Now, would they have been wearing uniforms, attending class?
Yep.
So your image of Lexington, that it was full of uniforms during...
We didn't see very much of them. They were kept pretty well shut up somewhere. I don't remember them very much. Bob saw them because he was the doctor for them. And he had to set up a whole pharmacy because the Army, of course, bought and sold its own drugs. And so down in that funny little office building, he had a whole pharmacy.
Which funny little office building?
It's near where Frank's office is. Where is Frank's office now?
Where the overnight guest sign is?
Yeah.
It was right by that.
Right by that. Well, it was one of those houses along there, which was the doctor's office.
That's what someone told me.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where Bob practiced all during the war, as well as there were times when BMI didn't have a doctor, and he ended up being both BMI in Washington and Lee Doctor, plus an enormous practice all over the county. 1,500 miles a month, and he never left the county. Yeah, it was a strange world. But we were incredibly lucky to have had this kind of Army installation. The cream of the crop. These extraordinary... No, those boys... This probably should be off the record, but one of the things that Bob had to do as part of being the doctor for these very healthy boys was a short arm examination, which kind of tickled him because it was so... and he had to do it at BMI, too. Do you suppose they still do it?
I would assume so. My husband talks about how he had to go through it when he was in the Army.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard of it. I was a total innocent. In fact, it wasn't until I went to Washington, was at the bookstore, that I got a good broad-ranged sex education for all those students who are totally uninhibited about partying.
Well, shall we make that leap? Shall we talk about
the
bookstore?
Have I told you what you want to hear?
Well, you've given me a real good picture of that time period, but I'd love to hear more if you want to talk about it.
I don't know. I had two children during that time.
Now, there's one thing before we go on. You mentioned someone named John Graham being important. I've never heard that name. Who's John Graham?
He's... long time descendant of the Grahams, who were among the founders of Washington and Lee. And he went to Princeton after Washington and Lee and got in graduate school. And he taught at Washington and Lee. He grew up in Washington and Lee. He was Mary Monroe's closest friend. He was extremely obese. He was in World War I, and he used to do his fatness exercises in the privy, and he used to make General Pershing, he was on General Pershing's staff doing something, he used to make General Pershing so mad because he would get in there and do his setting up exercises, and Pershing couldn't get in. I remember him telling that story.
But why was he so important at Washington and Lee, other than being a descendant of William Graham?
Yeah. At that time, before World War II, there was no art, no music, no drama at all. It took 200 years before they had any. And John, on his own, he taught Spanish and French. but on his own, he contributed what music there was. He contributed paintings. For instance, I remember him going around asking for signatures on a petition to buy a painting to go in the music room. He set up a music room upstairs in the library where he supplied records. Now, whether he got any money from Washington, and I rather doubt it, from Washington and Lee to buy records to go in his music room, I don't know. He was a composer. He did a lot of music for Mary Monroe in the Presbyterian Church choir, and that was something that I was surprised at when at Mary Monroe's funeral, that they didn't play any of John's music. One of the ones I remember the best was called Pavane on the Death of a Beautiful Friendship. He did very interesting things. He was a marvelous raconteur. He was at the core of our social group. And what he suggested that Dr. Leyburn to come here as dean of the university, which turned Washington and Lee around. There's no doubt about it. Washington and Lee had never named a building for a person who contributed themselves to a place. It had to be money before. That's the only building on campus that's named for, I guess, Gaines Hall. But
let's talk about Dean Leyburn. What was your experience of him?
I knew him very, very well. I have a folder of letters like this. Through John. John died in 1946, just before Jimmy came. And he was I spoke at the dedication of Leyburn Library, and as a person, Jimmy, as a friend, and he was part when he came, because we had loved John. Jimmy came into the group, and he was incredibly shy, I think. But the letters he would write were just wonderful. And this was the way he communicated. He had a hard time, and there were people. I remember Ollie Crenshaw at a dinner party once saying to me that the worst thing that had happened to Washington and Lee since Lee's surrender was Dr. Leyburn coming to Washington and Lee. Now that was, I guess he wasn't head of the history department then, but he became later. And I'm sure there were other people who felt that strongly. In fact, I know the word.
Why do you think they felt that way?
Because he didn't have, you better unhitch me.
Okay, let's get back to Jim Leyburn. And you were talking about Ollie Crenshaw, thinking he was the worst thing that ever happened.
Happened.
I'm fascinated by that. Tell me about that.
Well, Ollie was a great talker, for one thing. The students adored Leyburn. He never married, and his whole emotional life was wrapped up in his students. He'd been head of Sterling College at Yale and head of the sociology department there. And he told me we had him to dinner, to Sunday night supper, even before he'd unpacked all his books, and he had many books. And that night he told us, it was before school started that first fall, he told us, Bob and me, sitting out in the August dusk, that's in my speech, that when the invitation had come, he had walked the floor all night with excitement, dreaming about what he could do. And his goal, which he was very clear about, was make Washington and Lee the preeminent academic university of the South. And he did a pretty good job. He came at a time, or he got the blame for the abolition of subsidized athletics at Washington and Lee, football particularly. We were playing Army up there and trying to make money, and it was the most painful thing that Dr. Gaines ever had to do, I think, was to make athletics non-subsidized. They didn't buy players anymore. And the Lynchburg Alumni Association was livid, and they blamed it all on Jimmy Laban. That this was, he came along and was going to make a egghead school out of it, kind of. That was the feeling he took some very, very rough name calling, all sorts of things during that time. He was a superb musician, and I can see him now sitting at when those marvelous concerts that Mary Monroe would give. I remember the Foray Requiem, which they did for John after John Graham died, and Jimmy played the piano accompaniment. He practiced every day at 5:30 in the morning. When he corrected exams, he corrected the spelling along the side. I mean, he would correct. He did it instinctively, and I can't think and spell at the same time. And he insisted at the beginning that any auditors take the exams. And I gave that up, but I went on and audited, I think, just about everything that he, and we saw each other socially a great deal, all of us, in this, the John Graham circle. Mm-hmm. Although John was dead, he was dead before Jimmy came.
So why do you think Crenshaw had such a negative feeling about it?
I don't know. Bill Pusey felt that way. Even Bill and I used to go over and have lunch with Bill when he moved to the Colonnades, because he was trying to transport Lexington to Charlottesville. He was so lonely, so he missed Lexington, so I'd go over about every 2 months. And after we talked about Jimmy once or twice, it was sort of tacitly agreed that we didn't talk about it anymore. So
you think that Laban did make a huge difference?
Yes.
Tell me exactly what you mean by that.
Well, he was dean of the university, which they've never had since. It's dean of the college and dean of the commerce school and dean of the law school now. Well, he was dean of the whole thing. I don't know the actual technical innovative things that happened, except the kind of faculty he brought in was very interesting. Some of Marion Junkin, for instance, who incidentally was Jimmy Laban's first cousin. And then on the other side, Charlie Light, who was dean of the law school, was Jimmy Laban's first cousin. These things go in and out, my little New England, I learned to keep my head down, because John Graham used to say, "You are speaking of my cousin," about everybody in Bridge County.
So Charlie Light came after Laban?
Oh no, he did. He came before Laban, but he wasn't dean of the law school then. He was just on the faculty before Laban. I think he was probably already dean of the faculty when Laban came. It's just coincidence, really, yeah, that they were, their mothers were sisters or something. Academia is so squabbly. They thrive on it. You know, there's always academic ruckuses of one kind or another, I think. And I don't know what precipitated all of them. I do know that he never entertained the faculty. He never entered into bull sessions with the faculty. He was totally emotionally involved with the students teaching. He stayed on as dean until the middle 50s, I guess, and then he went back to being head of the sociology department. And then he retired and moved up. His family, it's a long, intricate family, owned a whole watercress farm up in, McKeesport, something up. Straight up 81, mm-hmm. You go right through it. And he did a lot of things. He wrote the definitive book up until recently on Haiti. That was his field. He wrote the best book that could possibly be on the Scotch-Irish. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. And then he did one about growing up in Durham, North Carolina after he retired. I didn't ever see that one. But he would, it was this one step removed relationships. For instance, in the campus mail, I would get a note saying, "I was going by your office today and I just thought how lucky we were to have you." This kind of.
But in note form, rather than stopping in to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Not one-on-one. Uh-huh. It was before Bob died, but he seemed awfully glad to see me. And one time, it was the last time I saw him, as a matter of fact. It was some big thing at
Lenfest. And then there was, everybody was milling around afterwards, and I looked up, and standing smack dab in the middle of the stage was Jimmy. And I didn't even know he was here, and so me, I go up, and he turned around and looked at me, and he was frail then, I thought. But he picked me up and spun me around twice, and it was just such fun to talk to him. And when I got back to, I'd gone with Connie Federman, the next door neighbor. And when she got back there, she said, "Who was that glamorous man who was whirling you around in the center of the stage?" We wrote a lot after he moved up there. And once I got a postcard from him from Oaxaca, and Monte Alban. And when I went to Oaxaca, I went, and I was just bowled over by it. And he had said in the postcard that this was one of the most extraordinary places he'd ever seen, or something like that. And I've always sort of thanked him for Monte Alban.
So I don't know where Oaxaca is.
In Mexico.
Oh.
It's fairly far south. It's on the border of the Chiapas area, which is having such trouble.
So he wrote to tell you how happy he was that you were there. Yep. Let's make that leap to the bookstore.
Yes.
How did that come to be?
Before I had anything to do with it, it was the result of part of the self-study of 1966. And it was the primary need of the university, according to the self-study, was an honest-to-God bookstore, not textbooks, but real books, as it were. And so they built this wing on the co-op building and stocked it. And they hired Jane Rushing to set it up, pick the books, set the whole thing up, which she did for 9 months, and from December till July. And then her husband got a job for a year as a visiting lecturer in Illinois. So I was sitting at a League of Women Voters luncheon one day, and she said they were going. And I said, "Could I mind the store?" And she said, "Well, I'll tell the committee." And they had a huge bookstore committee, great big. And so here I trotted over to be interviewed by all these people I'd known all my life. And there must have been eight or nine people in Mr. Whitehead's office. And I got hired. But this was an interim thing for 1 year. And I loved it. It was a round peg in a round hole. And Jane had done a beautiful job of setting up the policies, the standards, and importantly, the university was willing to underwrite a loss on it. It was considered part of the academic program, which was very wise, because you have to sell much larger volume to make any money on a bookstore, trade bookstore. And it was a fun year. It was an exciting year in that I figuratively jumped up and down and screamed and did anything that I could think of to attract attention, to stop them as they came through, to make them look around. And I participated as Well, and all these were things that Jane Rushing had taught me. I was there for a month before she left in June of 67. And I participated in whatever was going on in the university community, from lacrosse to having coffee and conversation with Betty Friedan, this kind of anything that happened, any lecturer, I would snag and have coffee and conversation. And there are some people who came who I would have sadly missed, like Arthur Ashe, who came and talked. He tried to talk about South Africa, and all they wanted to know was Borg going to beat Connors? So I enjoyed him, and many, many of them. That first year, I had a lot of, now what have we got?
Getting hired at the bookstore.
And then, at the end of the year, the last day, everything, in fact, Jane had come back for a few days to see, to look over everything, and pick up the reins, and, then the last day, everything was in perfect order, and my secretary and I were waxing the desk and making everything all right when the phone rang, and it was Jane from Maine, where her family had a summer place, and she was crying, and she said that she and Bob were getting a divorce, and she wasn't coming back.
Oh, my. That's pretty definitive, isn't it?
And she was, this was the 30th of June, and my contract ran out that day. And she said, I'm calling you so you'll have time to think whether you want to do it anymore. And she said, I'll call Mr. Whitehead and tell him. And I was there for 16 years. It was wonderful. It was the most exciting thing I ever did in my life. I loved it, and I got involved in the things like American Booksellers Association on the national level, being on committees with Maya Angelou and people. That was always fun, and. The National College Stores Association, although I had nothing to do with anything but, for the first 7 years, anything but the trade books, the general books. And then it was, changes came along, and it had been obvious to me from the beginning that to run the textbooks and the general books, to buy textbooks from Macmillan and general books from Macmillan and have two accounts, and it was a mess. And so it was changed. And I did the textbooks, but I never did mugs and T-shirts and stuff like that.
So did you have any training for this at all, or were you just thrown into it?
Well,
and started to swim.
Jane was good training because she had learned from scratch. She was teaching at the high school, and it was the high school, and so she took the job at $5,500, which was what I was paid, No, I learned by going to state meetings, for one thing. And after 2 years, I felt I was ready to go to bookseller school. I knew enough to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Oberlin for 2 weeks, Washington Lee Page, for me to go to Oberlin for 2 weeks and take the whole bookseller's course. There again, I got to know more people in the whole business of bookselling and books, and wrote the in the manual of bookselling, which the American Bookseller Association published 35,000 copies. I wrote the chapter on selling trade books in college bookstores and university college bookstores, and I became, through, I don't know how, but I was a judge of the National Book Award in poetry.
Really?
Yep.
What an honor.
Well, it was incredible. I wrote it down. And they were deciding that they would include that year booksellers. So members of the ABA got a chance to write down that they were going to, what they would be interested in. And I wrote down two things. One was history, because a very close friend, an old beau of mine, had an impressive book published, and I wanted to see that it got the National Book Award. It didn't. It got the Pulitzer later. But and the other reason was I like poetry, and had always read a great deal of poetry and still do. And so I put down poetry and I got picked for no qualifications at all. Never had a poem published in my life.
Isn't that interesting? Well, tell me about a day in the bookstore.
There was no day like any other day. Things would, I could hardly wait to get there, because things would happen. There would be some kind of ruckus, or some kind of excitement, or things that had to be planned. And there were things that we did every day. I had anywhere from 8 to 12 student work-study boys. There were only boys while I was there. It went co-ed the year I was called Betty the Red, not because I voted for McGovern or anything like that, but because I was in favor of co-education. And the boys had certain, all of the boys who worked had certain jobs that they did. They kept the inventory. They, what was called reading yellow cards, and you'd write down how many were on the shelf. And any that had one or none were put in a box, and I would go through and decide whether to reorder, and depending on how many had been sold. And of course, there would be a particular book that would be the rage, and you'd have to keep ahead of that, or you'd lose out. Every few days, every week, certainly every week, I changed the table and what was on it. When Tolkien died, for instance, I went out and stole some of the Atwood's flowers that were on clematis, and put it in a circle around the obituary on the table. And some, I did not, just a single thing to attract attention was the way I did it. Now, Sue does it just the opposite, and I think it's equally, I mean, she's got her table loaded with books, the display table. And then there'd be somebody, particularly Monday morning, if I didn't read the New York Times books section on Sunday, there would be a faculty member by 9 o'clock in the morning who was in there, who was saying, there's a book reviewed in the New York Times book section. I've forgotten the name and the author. It's about, that's about all they would give you. And I wanted to be able to call that book. And I usually did for special order. And that was a great deal. And running books down to see whether they were in print, that kind of thing, which should be done right away. We prided ourselves on the fact that we could get books in 5 days. But that was, and that was part. Brenda really did the work, my secretary did the work in the bookstore, the Scott work, the endless Scott work, while I talked, and talked to students all the time, as much as I could. I was like Jimmy Labrin. But I certainly got to know the faculty too, and that was interesting because I hadn't realized that in the League of Women Voters and the library and all those things that I had worked on, I had known wives. And now I was getting to know their husbands. And we had a wonderful time. And I hung paintings by local people up above the bookcases, bookshelves. So there was all those kind of things that I did. And after I got into doing textbooks, that was the impossible, but you one aimed at it, task of having every faculty member's books on the shelf in the number. And I changed it from what it had been before. Before, they had ordered the number that the faculty member wrote down. And as one of the standard stories that the UVA bookseller, a guy came in and wrote down the number of textbooks he wanted ordered. And it was the number of seats there were in the room. And those were the kind of things you had to watch very carefully, because you only got a 20% discount on textbooks, and all you probably know all this. All the and you had to pay shipping coming and going. You could return them for credit, but by the time you had done all that, you had to cut very carefully the number.
Did you then work with the registrar to make sure how many people?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I took the privilege, if you want to call it that, away from the faculty of picking the numbers, and we kept a track record of the number, and we would go by the registration, and then that last night or two nights before classes start in the fall, they print out the registration, the final registration. No, there's a week of drop ads, so you have to play with that too after classes have started. But I and all the faculty were over there about 7:30 at night, getting the printout of how many there were, and what you would do would be to go down in a hurry and find out where you were short and hit the phones before the faculty came along and breathed down your neck. And you could just say, yeah, we called that in this morning. We picked it up right away.
And so how much time would you have between when they registered for the classes and when they came in to buy the textbooks?
4 or 5 days.
Ooh, that's tight.
Yeah. Yes, it's tight. And every college in the country is calling into the publisher at the same time. And so you walked a tightrope all the time. And the faculty couldn't understand why you couldn't just order 5-10 over. Well, when you're cutting it at a margin so thin, after I did take up the textbooks, add the textbooks to it, the advantage of buying back books secondhand and reselling them. You buy them back at half price and resell them at a quarter off. And so you make that little margin, which makes all the difference. And the staff that was there before weren't administrative people. The gal had done it for time immemorial, and she didn't understand any possible changes. So I made a profit. Mr. Whitehead, I don't think quite really believed it. And with the exception of two or three people, faculty, it was a very, very pleasant relationship.
We need to switch tapes.
This is enough, isn't it?